So I will mention Talfescue, I'm sure that's why you folks are leaving. So I work with Birdsfoot Trefoil, and for anybody who hasn't come to one of my talks in the last several years, it's a productive and persistent, deep-rooted, tannin-containing legume that I think grows well on higher pH soils, other places too, but we talk about the protein precipitation, but tannins also are well known to bind and precipitate alkaloids as well. So that's the tie-in to Talfescue. So we've done some studies in Utah using endophyte-infected Talfescue, even though we usually don't use that. We use Talfescue that's endophyte-free. But we did a study in which lambs were fed endophyte-infected Talfescue, and I say we, my colleague Juan Villalba and his students, in which lambs were fed endophyte-infected Talfescue supplemented with Birdsfoot Trefoil, and compared with the endophyte-infected Talfescue alone, they consumed more D-plus Talfescue. And then lambs that were supplemented with alfalfa did not increase the amount of endophyte-infected Talfescue that they consumed. And then in another study, it's a little more complicated, but using Sandpoint, another tannin-containing legume, or Sicer milk vetch, which is non-bloating but not tannin-containing, they were supplemented with a ration that consisted of endophyte-free Talfescue seed, beet pulp, and alfalfa pellets, and then half of each of those two groups was subsequently at the red arrow offered the same ration but with endophyte-infected Talfescue seed. And what you can see after the red arrow is the two lines that fall off there. One, the lower one, the dark one, is Sicer milk vetch supplemented animals, and the clear squares is the Sandpoint supplemented animals. And you can see that after about a week, they were back up to the same amount of the ration, even though it contained endophyte-infected Talfescue seed, and it was pretty hot. So although Birdsfoot Trefoil may not be the most persistent legume on lower pH soils, we do think that, at least in concept, we should explore this possibility that tannins can offset the negative effects of the alkaloids produced by endophyte-infected Talfescue. And my colleague Edzar Van Santen, who was at Auburn at the time, received a grant from the USDA to do a number of things on the way to developing a broadly adapted cultivar of Birdsfoot Trefoil that would include adaptation in the eastern transition zone. And so I was part of that study, and I will tell you about that objective, my part of that objective. So we screened 133 accessions, and they were germinated in the greenhouse and then transplanted to the field where they were evaluated for winter survival and growth in the year following planting, and that was done in northern Alabama, Michigan, and Utah. And this is a photograph of the seedlings growing in containers. So we had 28 containers of each accession in the greenhouse, and this is one bench. We had two benches of these plants. And this is the way the field was set up. So we transplanted the established fields, established plants to the fields in early June, and in our case, and we planted 10 of the plants of each accession in a row, 2 feet apart, and then the rows were 3 feet apart. And we had two replications at each of the three locations. And in Utah, we put down ground cloth on the entire acre to try to suppress weeds. I had not done a space plant study before, and I don't have a technician. So we collected whole stems of each of the plants that were surviving in each of the 10 plants from the accession and each rep. At each location, and they were analyzed for tannins using the method published by John Graber, which essentially gets out all the tannins. So we sometimes talk about extractable and bound tannins, but this is a total tannin assay. And you can see that across all the locations, there was quite a range, and a few plants really went up into the very high tannin concentrations. But I'll tell you about some differences just in location effects. So for all of the accessions grown in these respective locations, Auburn, Michigan State, and Utah, the tannin concentrations were higher in Alabama and Michigan than they were in Utah. And I looked closely at the data, and in every case where there was a difference for the location for a given accession, it was lower for Utah. So the tannin expression of the same germplasm is less under our climate conditions. And some of the other field data that I'm going to just share with you for the Utah location is described here. We looked at herbage dry matter in grams per plant, the number of plants out of 10 and a rep that survived, the plant diameter in centimeters, so just looking down on it from above. The number of stems were scored, and so this score that was our average of 3.8 equates to about 50 stems. There's a little scale down on the bottom right. And then growth habit was rated, and with one being entirely upright and nine being prostrate, and our students were trained with the same photographs to estimate that. And so our average growth habit was fairly prostrate, even though Edzard selected germplasm for upright growth. And so then I'll just share a few, just nine different accessions, if I have time, and just share with you, especially the tannin concentration versus survival in the field. So these first three I picked out because we planted, in some sense, five seeds in each of our containers of the 28. And so then what I looked for was containers that I didn't have to replant. And there were very few. There were three where I just had 28 plants coming up. And then we thinned them down to one plant. But these are those three. And I've got the days to germination listed there. And then the mean tannin concentration, and you can see it's about 2 to 2.5 for two of those, and then the other one was about twice that, and it just didn't survive in the field in Michigan or in Utah, either one. And so sometimes these higher tannin concentration birds foot trefoils are from more warm climates, so perhaps that explains part of it. And I just wanted to show them to you. So the two with good field growth and survival are on the left and in the middle, and then the one on the right is the one that has the high tannin concentration that didn't survive in Utah, and you can see how that's pretty prostrate. Some of them hardly made it out of the container. They were so small. The next three entries that I looked at to show you today, we only had to replant a few containers, that third column there, and they had reasonable days to germination, and one of those also had very high tannin concentrations, and it survived in our location, sort of, and at Auburn, but you can see that there was just one, on average, of the two reps, one plant that survived out of the 10, and the dry weight wasn't the best, but that speaks to how small that plant is. And then it was also very prostrate. You can tell that by the 7, and then the other plant, the 7.81. The higher the number, the more prostrate the accession. And then looking at these, the Ethiopian ones, and these were identified by Craig Roberts and others in other studies, are often high in tannins. And then you can see the prostrate one here on the right. 9 days to germination, and by the number of containers that we had to replant, we sort of were in the range of 80% germination. And then the last three that had, I thought, reasonably good germination. One of those didn't survive in the field, not because it had particularly high tannin concentration, but it did survive at Auburn. And so I think we have some interesting germplasm that Dr. Van Santen has selected here. And we often get high yield and good survival of most germplasm at Utah. And so one of the factors that we want to do is we want to release a variety that has applicability across a broad range of environments, so that it's just hard to get people to produce these orphanish legumes. And so we don't want bird's foot trefoil to just get into one of those death spirals because it has a lot of good traits. But anyway, I think that's all that I have.
Questions?
Yes, Ben.
So, why do you speculate tannin concentrations were lower in your Utah site, it looked like?
You know, my pet theory, and I don't have any data, I don't think, to really back it up, is that we have abiotic stresses. We have, you know, dry climate. Our evapotranspiration is much higher, so that even when we irrigate, these plants are really having a lot of water drawn through them. So we have cool nights. And I think personally that the reason we see more tannin consistently with John Greber's study that he did too, at other locations, and West Virginia had very high tannin concentrations in a different study, is just, I think they're being more challenged by biotic stress. And we know that they tend to have more leaf and crown disease problems. And that's part of the reason they're less persistent in more humid climates. And Paul Buselink speculated too that the dry climate was very favorable for this much better growth with his, I think it was Steadfast variety. Well, I think that they may be diverting photosynthesis to tannins for their own reasons, because I think that general, it's a hypothesis that you certainly hear even more about in natural resources kinds of or environmental studies, and I think it's so overarching that we need to question it, like Lynn was saying. We can't just be that broad about secondary plant products. So we also know that they are a way. It's kind of a release valve. If they're in a situation like trees in the fall, when they accumulate a lot of anthocyanins and have that wonderful bright red color, that's just them diverting the products of photosynthesis that they no longer need into something where they can put it. And so these plants may just be used to putting things into tannins, just to put them someplace.
Could that also be the explanation as to why some of your smaller, more stressed-looking plants had higher condensed tannins, because they were just unhappy, and therefore they were trying to protect what little vegetation they had?
Well, those little guys were in containers, and we were spritzing them and watering them, and they had lots of nutrients and so on. And so I think what you saw in those containers was their genetic happy place. And so they weren't stressed there, and so the field data, we had surprisingly good, we had very few that just didn't produce, but some of those happened to be, of the 133, happened to be the ones that also germinated very quickly. So that would be too bad if the ones that germinate fast are the ones that die fast, too. Yes, Harley. We were a little behind on some of ours, I know, but I've talked to Kim and I've talked to Edzard, and so he I know, was being very careful to go out every week and make sure that the ones that were just beginning to flower were the ones that he sampled. And so that was the standard that we all were working toward. So they should have been roughly at the same stage of development for their time to flower.
Let's thank our speaker.